within America of socialist and communist propagandists dedicated to the establishment of a new order.
The communists?
I'll guarantee that 10 minutes from now, a lot of you are going to have a new understanding of communism.
The United States is living through a revival in the class struggle. There's a fresh layer of the working class, especially young people, that support trade unions, want to organize, and want to fight for workers' rights and for a better society. To discuss a little bit more about the situation in the labor movement today and the traditions of class struggle unionism that we defend, we have Tom Trottier here with us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about what is the state of the labor movement today?
Well, I would say the best way to describe it, it's a mixed picture, right? On the one hand, we have a leadership of the trade unions in the United States, which is completely out of touch. They are people who accept capitalism. They have no confidence in the working class to transform society. And because they therefore accept capitalism as a system, they therefore accept all the limitations of capitalism. And since capitalism is in decline, what their policies are doing is they're chaining the workers to a sinking ship, so to speak. But there's another side to the equation. Unions are the first line of defense for all workers, right? When you work at a workplace, it's you versus the boss. And if it's just one worker against the boss, he or she's got no hope in that battle. The only possibility to push back against the boss is for the united collective organization of all the workers at that workplace or all the workers in that industry. That's even better if you can do that. It's to push back against the boss. And if you look at that side of the equation, it's actually an exciting period in labor. You have, first of all, a big rise in strikes. You know, relatively, in the last few years, you've seen a lot more strike activity than you had for the prior period. Now, it may not be to the same level as you saw in the 1960s and 70s, but it's much higher than it was like just a few years back. You saw some big strikes like the actor strike, the writer strike, the auto strike that the United Auto Workers went on strike against GM, Stellantis, and Ford last year. You see a whole series of strikes like this. And you also have attempts to organize the unorganized. For example, Starbucks, for example, Apple Computers, right? REI. I don't know if you heard, but the UAW just won a victory in Tennessee. They organized the Volkswagen plant that was in Tennessee. That was a great step forward. So you see that kind of mixture. You see it, the working class is trying to go on the offensive, is trying to fight back against the attacks of the bosses, but they are limited by their leadership.
Yeah, and in terms of the revival of support for trade unions, just want to give some statistics. 71% of all Americans across party lines supports trade unions, has a positive view of trade unions, which is a big uptick compared to previous years. But as among young people, people who are under 30 years of age, there's 88% of support. That is huge. That's nearly 9 in 10 young people who have a favorable view of unions. And that also shows this is in line with the other side, the political side of it, which we're saying that for young people, a lot of them are supportive of socialism. They're critical of capitalism. They're even supportive of communism. So I think you can see this is all part of the same wave of radicalization that we've observed over the last period. You'd mentioned the question of Starbucks. We actually have a comrade who works at a different coffee shop in Philadelphia. What's the name
of it? Bluestone, I think, is the name of the coffee shop.
I'm Sofia Sarabo. I joined the organization in late October of 2023. I work at Bluestone Lane Cafe in Rittenhouse Square. I work full-time as the head barista. I have been working there for about 3 weeks now, and I essentially just make all the drinks my entire shift and push them out in hopefully under 2 minutes is the expectation. On my second shift, it was brought to my attention by one of my coworkers. They handed me union pins and they said, don't wear them yet because it's not public. And at that point, I had no idea what was happening with it. But I mean, even on my second shift, I could kind of figure out exactly why they were looking to unionize. I mean, I think all workplaces should unionize it to some degree, or all workers should be organizing. It was very crazy to see the response after we sent the petition in. My manager became extremely paranoid and worried. Like, area-wide management came into the store to observe all of us working. And then the co-owner of the chain restaurant of the company, Andy Stone, came into the restaurant. He gave us no warning that he was coming in. And this man lives in New York, in the suburbs of New York, so it's not like he was just in the neighborhood or anything. But he came in to talk to every single individual employee alone. What he said was to give us an educated vote. Thus, you know, the voters for the union. So one by one, I watched him sit down every employee that was working there. He sat me down and he asked me, you know, what I knew about the union. And I told him, I was like, not very much. Like, I've only been working here for at that point, like a week and a half, 2 weeks. He proceeded to act like I didn't know much about unions in general. I explained the role of a union and what they do. But again, like a boss would explain a union. He's like, unions are good, but only for companies that don't pay you well. And Bluestone Lane pays above the market rate. Now, I don't know what market rate he was talking about, because all of the servers make $7.25 an hour. So it is just minimum wage. And I'm the head barista, and I only make $8.25 an hour. And then he said, if we raise your wages as well, we would have to raise all of the menu prices, which is absolute nonsense. They wouldn't have to do that. They would want to do that, because I broke down the cost of a commodity for him. I said, the way you price your food, the way you price your drinks, is based off of the labor that I use. You are paying for my labor, a portion of it. You're also paying for the raw materials and fixing equipment, which they don't. They do not fix equipment ever. Then the rest of that money is your paycheck. So I asked him plainly, I said, do you think your paycheck is comparable to mine? Because I don't. Before we even had these one-on-ones, he was talking about how, oh yeah, his wife just had her third kid. They just got a new house in the suburbs of New York. And I told him, I can't afford any of these things. I would never be able to afford any of these things, being a tipped worker or working for your company especially. And tipped workers are forced to save every penny they have. I don't overspend anything. I buy the bare necessities because I don't know what my next paycheck will ever bring me. And he was completely dumbfounded that I would call out how much he's making or ask him anything about his paycheck. So he started to stumble over his words a lot. He started to sweat through his shirt, which I found a little bit reassuring that I was doing a good job of being the communist in this situation. I made sure to speak loud enough because I was still new to this workplace. I still am, and I'm still trying to find who the communists are there. So I thought if they hear me directly speaking to my boss, they'll see that I'm serious about what I'm doing, and I'm serious about fighting for change. And you know, this isn't just a small company either. They have about 60 locations, and they're trying to build 15 new ones before the end of 2024. So he's got some money in his pockets. But this was also a great opportunity for me to tell all of my coworkers about May Day and to talk about the organization that I'm part of, the party I'm building. And they were very receptive. I told them that they have an open stage on May Day, which May Day is going to be a huge event for Philadelphia. We are trying to reclaim this holiday and take it back. And we're inviting all the labor unions, all the workers' organizations, all the communists, all the class fighters in Philadelphia to come out and speak in our open mic section and share their story in this struggle.
There's a basic understanding that Marxism makes conscious, but I think every worker understands this, that all of value in society is created as a byproduct of human labor, right? Wealth comes from human labor engaged with the natural resources of the world. That's where wealth comes from. It doesn't come from the boss, it comes from the worker. And yet, most of the wealth stays in the hands of a few people at the top, and the masses on the bottom who are producing all the wealth get very little. Just to give you an example, the richest 10% in the United States own almost 3/4 of all the wealth in the country. The richest 10%, so the people who don't do the work, but own the factories, they own the businesses, they own the stores and all that, they collect all the wealth. So that's something that's just a burning injustice. And that is actually the reason why so many people are looking to unions now in a positive way. That's why they're organizing. Frankly, the labor leaders, the leaders of the AFL-CIO cannot take credit for this. In fact, I bet if we go on the street right now and we ask people, who's the president of the AFL-CIO? I bet very few people are going to know. I think they've been put in the witness protection program or something. there's no attempt by the labor movement to use the resources of these unions. They have wonderful offices in Washington, by the way, beautiful. Where are their resources to start a real campaign to fight against the boss? So all of the rise in positive feelings towards unions comes from the fact of the instinctual understanding the workers have that they are creating the wealth, and yet the wealth is in the hands of these few people. Just another thing I just also want to be that might be helpful for anyone listening to this podcast is when we use the term union, let's explain what we mean by union. Because when we grow up in American capitalism, the ruling class dictates what these words mean. And if you talk to people, sometimes they get this idea that the union is something from outside that comes into the workplace. But that is not a union. A union is not an entity that comes out from outside the workplace and is brought in. A union is not people you hire to negotiate for you with the boss. That's not a union. A union is all of the workers united together. That's a real union. So if you organize a workplace, it means you have banded all the workers together into a union. And the fact that that workplace gets united with other workplaces, that means that the union goes beyond the workplace. It can be industrial-wide. It could be national. It could be even international. That's what we mean by union. And we're going to challenge the definitions that are being given to us by the ruling class about what a union really is. Because if you get a real sense of a real union, that changes the whole way we look at the labor movement and the potential power that can come from organizing workers.
Now, if anyone has ever been involved, any of our listeners has ever been involved in a unionization effort at their workplace, they probably heard a lot of that propaganda from the bosses, right? As soon as they get a whiff, they'll sit you down and they're going to try to convince the workers that the union's a bad idea. And that's precisely how they frame it. They say, oh, a union's coming in and they're going to make you pay monthly dues. Did you know that? And they're going to try to intimidate you that this thing coming in from the outside that you're just paying to, they don't really care about you. And I do, you know, and somehow the boss cares about you, you know, which is obviously not true. Well, they care about making profit off of us. But I think that's actually also, you see on the other side, sometimes that's how the union operates. Like sometimes when they do these organizing efforts, the bureaucracy will send a staffer in who's not a worker at that workplace, and they'll just go around and try to get, you know, say 50% of cards signed saying, okay, 50% of the workplace might be interested in forming a union. It's done from the outside, and it's not like from the bottom up. It's not actually an organic organizing with a committee from the rank and file. And those are precisely the efforts that tend to fall flat. This makes me think of the Amazon organizing effort that happened. Was that in Alabama?
Alabama, yes.
What year was that, 2021?
Yeah, it was a few years ago, I think that was RWDSU.
That's right. And usually that's when you actually don't see a lot of success, because the union is perceived by the worker as some kind of foreign entity that comes in, like an institution that comes in from the outside, as opposed to being seen as the workers banding together, as you said. Actually, we see that the power of the workers comes from the fact that they can go on strike and that they can paralyze the company, paralyze the profits of the bosses, show the boss who actually runs that company, who actually produces all those goods. And it's very significant that it's not just that there's a rising popularity of trade unions, but also 75% of the population, that's 3/4 of all Americans, support workers going on strike. So that in itself is extremely significant.
Yes. I mean, you know, the thing with a strike is that if the workers are creating the wealth through their labor, right? They're the ones that are adding value to making these commodities that the capitalists can sell for profit, right? Then if they stop doing that, the flood of profits are stopped, right? The capitalists need the workers. The capitalists cannot be capitalists without workers. The workers don't need the capitalists. We can get into that later. They don't really need that kind of person to be a parasite to suck the blood from them. They don't need that. But the opposite is not true. The owners, the capitalists, need the workers. Without the workers, they'll never be able to make that kind of money. Mm-hmm. When they say, like, they got rich the old-fashioned ways, yeah, they got rich the old-fashioned way. They exploited people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one statistic that you've mentioned a few times, Tom, which is this question of the GDP. And what share of the GDP do the workers get? Do you have that handy?
Yeah, actually, just if you look, I'm using 2023 figures that I got. We should caution the listener, by the way, the capitalists don't record statistics exactly the way Marxists would, but it's a rough estimation. If you take the total gross domestic product, all those goods and services that are produced, and in 2023, divide it by the amount of wage workers, it's over 121 million, right, wage and salary workers in the United States. So just roughly as an average, right, each worker in 2023 produced $225,636.50. But how many workers got anywhere near that kind of salary, right? Maybe there's a few high-paid workers who did a lot of overtime, but very few workers in the United States make $225,636.50. Now, by the way, we as communists, we are not proposing that would be the solution to take the production and distribute it equally among the workers. We have a different vision of society and how it actually would liberate all of humanity. I just want to be that clear. But that shows you, I think that's the essence. It shows you where the money's going. And it shows you when we talk about having free national health care, free education, retirement at age 50, we can show people how this can be paid for.
So I think that's a good segue to talk about the struggle for workers' rights, the struggle for unionizations. How does that connect to the struggle for communism, right? Because obviously we are communists and we understand that ultimately we need to fight for a revolution, to overthrow capitalism, and to have a new form of society. And so how does that connect to the fight of the unions and the labor movement today?
I would argue that the fight for unions logically leads you to the fight for communism, and I'll explain. So first of all, there is an inherent contradiction between the boss and the worker. In order for the worker to live a decent life, they cannot do it within chained in the system of capitalism. Capitalism does not allow that, right? Even when they collectively organize in unions, and even when they fight back, there are limits to what they can get because capitalism is not a system that produces to make things. It produces for profits. It only produces something, whether it's useful or not, if they can make money from it. If not, they're not going to do it. You know, if you raise the wages and benefits high enough, right, and it becomes not profitable for the capitalists to produce that particular goods or service, then they stop it, right, or they cut down on their production. So that's the first contradiction, is that in the struggle of the working class, even on a trade union level, to improve their lives, to improve their working conditions, to improve their benefits, they are going to go head on into a collision with the limits of the capitalist system. And as people see that, right, as people see those limits, people start to understand, right? They learn through their experience. Lenin used to say, life teaches. It's through that experience that people learn and they start drawing conclusions. And remember what I was saying before. We know capitalists need workers. We know that because without them, they can't make that money. But do workers really need capitalists? Can we organize production in a different way? Can, instead of having an anarchic market system determine what is produced and how much is produced, couldn't we democratically get together and decide how to produce things, what to produce, where society is going to invest. How much should we invest in housing? How much should we invest in education and healthcare? How much should we invest in parks and recreation? How much should we invest in entertainment? These things could be decided democratically. People will understand that as a byproduct of their struggle, right? I think a lot of people start out, a lot of workers start out, first becoming conscious of trade unions and the need to have a trade union to struggle against, collectively against the boss. But once they start that at their workplace, they're not going to say, geez, it's only at my single workplace that I need a union. Everybody else is okay. No, you start to generalize from that. And you start saying, well, of course, it's not just my factory. It's not just my employer. It's all workers everywhere. So then they start to draw a broader, what we would call class consciousness. They understand we are a class the working class. We exist nationally. In fact, we don't just exist nationally. We exist internationally. When I'm working at this factory, we get parts shipped to us from Taiwan. So that means there's a worker in a factory in Taiwan producing parts to send to my factory. And then when we're done, we ship this, let's say, to Canada. That means there's a Canadian worker that has to handle this incoming freight, you know, and then distribute it, right? So people start to see that the class actually exists not just on a national basis, but on an international basis. So there you start having not only class consciousness, but international consciousness of the working class. So people start to question, why do we have to accept the limits of this system? And then when they, by the way, when they fight the boss, they very, very quickly learn that what the politicians and the media and the education and the facilities, all the religious leaders, they always talk about our government. This is our government. It's our constitution. Well, you find out, is it really our government when you go on strike and the police stop you from having a picket line to shut down the factory, right? Or when everything that you do is being attacked by the state apparatus, then you find out it's not really our government and in the sense of being a government of the working class. It's our government in the sense it's a capitalist government. It's only our if you're a capitalist. And the rest of the people, that government is not in their hands. So then people start to draw a conclusion, maybe we need our government like a workers' government. And once people start to draw these conclusions, once you start seeing this, you will not unsee it. You will gain politically. And this is how consciousness can arise just from the conditions. Now, of course, those conditions open people up to ideas. They start exploring ideas and they start seeing, oh, wow, what did Marx have to say about this? What did Lenin have to say about this? You know, and there's a communist group, the RCA. What do they have to say about that? People start to look for answers. And then, of course, in the engagement in that political discussion, they start seeing a different kind of world and a different possible outcome for their lives than the misery that they're living under capitalism.
Absolutely. And so we see this process of the development of class consciousness as an integral part of the fight for revolution, right? And we see that actually those battles can start to push against the limits of the system. If our listeners are interested in learning more about that relationship between reforms and the fight within capitalism and the fight for revolution and how these fights are not one or the other, but actually are interconnected, I would recommend reading Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg is a very good book, or also What is to be Done is an excellent discussion about what role we should play in terms of supporting those movements, but not just being cheerleaders, actually trying to use them to escalate things always one step more and try to raise the class consciousness to see the need for socialist transformation of society.
We as communists, right, what we always would tell workers, it's better to be organized than to not be organized. And then we would make that point again, that a union is all the workers united together. That's what a union is. That's where their power. We would also say that not only that they have the power to change things, but it's only the working class that can transform things for the working class. They should have no trust or no confidence in any other, you know, foreign class institution. To give an example, we should put no confidence or faith that the National Labor Relations Board, that the courts, that politicians are going to somehow protect things. I'll give you an example. Many labor leaders have been saying that, Joe Biden, he's there for the worker. He's fine. In fact, Sean Fain, the new head of the United Auto Workers Union, was elected a couple years ago. And one of his big mistakes is he endorsed Joe Biden, right? And when I mean it's a mistake, I'm not saying he should have endorsed Trump. He should not have endorsed any capitalist politician. He should have been fighting for the working class. If we're going to participate in elections, the working class should have its own independent candidates representing the interests of the working class. That's what should have happened. But he endorsed Joe Biden. Now, if he tells workers to have confidence in Joe Biden, let's look at Joe Biden's record. When the railway workers were going to go on strike, right? A majority of the workers, there was like 11 different rail unions, and they rejected, overall the vote was they rejected the settlement, right? Immediately, Congress, on the behest of the Biden administration, made that strike, any potential strike by the railroad, illegal. So how can you put your trust, how can you put your confidence in a politician that is owned and controlled by the capitalist class? You can't, right? The workers can only rely on themselves, their own class institutions, their own unions, and we would argue they should have their own political party. There has to be a political party that represents the working class.
Mm-hmm. How shameful it is that the unions, basically for the last many decades, they've just been supporting the capitalist parties, and especially they've operated really as an appendage of the Democratic Party. That means that all the dues from the rank and file and the membership end up funding this capitalist party that is an anti-worker party, as you pointed out. And how shameful, too, that people like AOC, right, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who this so-called squad and these so-called self-described socialists, incorrectly described socialists, voted in favor of illegalizing the railroad worker strikes, right? Yes.
Well, those are people, they may call themselves socialists, but remember, they're elected as Democrats. So their loyalty, again, it's not, they are not candidates put up by a working class party under the Democratic control of the working class. They're not, right? They're Democrats. They're in the, regardless of what they call themselves, they're Democrats. And therefore, in the end, almost all of them voted to illegalize the strike.
And also how shameful groups like the CPUSA, which we talk a little bit about them in one of our earlier episodes about Leninism and genuine Leninism. This is certainly no communist party in name only. And they also basically endorsed the Democrats. And when Sean Fain came out and saying that the UAW was going to endorse Joe Biden for the 2024 election, by the way, this is Genocide Joe we're talking about. In that same meeting, there was a little bit of a protest for Palestine against the ongoing massacre of tens of thousands of innocent people in Gaza. And the protest was shut down. They kicked people out there. So
we should point out, there are many members of the UAW who are completely against supporting U.S. imperialism and Zionism in the Middle East. And those are the people who they attacked. Those were members of the UAW who were being, put out of their own meeting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. I just wanted to quote a headline from the CPUSA when the UAW endorsed Biden. Here's the headline. Biden to UAW. Donald Trump is a scab.
Yeah, we should point out it's not about Trump and Biden being scabs. They're the enemy class who hire the scabs to break the unions, both of them. And whatever anti-worker stuff people want to say about Trump, it's true. But the implication of what the Communist Party is saying is that somehow Biden is better. And by the way, when the UAW was on strike, Biden came to the picket line, which he did for political reasons, right? But he didn't raise a finger to help the UAW in that strike. What did he do? What concrete action did he take that helped the UAW in that strike? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. In my opinion, Sean Fain, when Biden came to the picket line, he should have said, "Get off. You're on the other side of the barricades. You represent the bosses. An injury to one is an injury to all." That was a slogan. That's a slogan still in the labor movement. You injured the railway workers. That's a fight against the UAW as well. It's a fight. It's a slap in the face to the auto workers. Get off this line. That's what he should have said.
Mm-hmm. Actually, from that CPUSA article, here's what they said. Biden carried out his promise to be the most pro-union president in history. Not only is this an absolute lie, but it's like a campaigning, right, for the Democrats to be reelected, which is absolutely disgusting. Now, one thing I wanted to mention, too, about how the struggles of workers point out those contradictions of the system was the miners' strike in Alabama, 2021 to 2023. This is the longest miners' strike in the history of the U.S., by the way, a strike of warrior met coal workers. And that was a real lesson for the workers that were involved in that on two questions. One, you had the workers realizing that the ruling class tries to divide us on all kinds of lines, on the question of race, the question of gender, on the question of, you know, are you a Trumpist or are you, you know, Democrat or Republican? These are all cultural lines, identity lines, right? That the ruling class uses these tactics to divide and conquer and try to say, we're not, the working class shouldn't all unite. Look, you have all these differences.
Rural and urban, southern and northern, all that, yeah.
Exactly. And so in order to win the strike, they realize the need for unity and how they shouldn't let themselves be divided. In fact, there's a very good interview that the Daily podcast held with these workers. Of course, that's a liberal New York Times sponsored podcast. So there's a lot of political limitations to it, but it was very insightful.
We put always sort of labels or how we identify Democrat, Republican. Do you identify most primarily as
I consider myself a union worker. You know, that's what I am. And
they also realized that the politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, were against them.
When they say that they support the coal industry, I guess they were telling the truth. You know, they supported the industry and not the worker. You know, they supported the company and not the worker. And we're seeing that more, you know, clear as the strike goes on. The picture just gets clearer as time goes on. I'd like to actually see from either side just, you know, a change toward the workers of the country. I mean, just me as a, you know, average working class American, I can't see where either side has done anything to help the working class.
So that's how you said life teaches, right? And these are the very hard battles. Unfortunately, the strike was not successful. And that maybe this brings us a little bit to this point that you made earlier about the weaknesses of this revival in the class struggle, which is to say, like, yes, this is very significant that there's been an increase in the number of strikes, an increase in efforts to unionize, the popularity of unions is going up. But we're coming from a historic lull, like a low point of the trade union movement in the United States. Just to give you one figure, one example of this, last year there were 33 strikes involving 1,000 or more workers, so 33 large strikes. That's up from 23 in 2022. That's a big increase in the number of strikes. And the strikes in 2022 involved basically about 120,000 workers. And in 2023, it involved 460,000. So that's almost four times as many workers that participated in strikes. But compare those figures to the 1960s and 1970s, when you had 300, 400 strikes involving 1,000 workers or more, right? That's kind of where we're coming from. There's a lot of work to be done in terms of rebuilding a labor movement that has been decimated over the past few decades.
I mean, first of all, like, take a look at the UAW strike that happened last fall in 2023. Now, that strike, in some ways, it was a very good strike. And I'll tell you why it was good. They did fight back. And we've always said this as communists, right? If you fight back, you get more than if you don't fight back. I mean, I know it's a simple thing, but it's actually true, you know? And if you look at what they were able to achieve with that contract definitely was better than what you've seen, you know, for maybe at least 20 years, maybe possibly even longer than 20 years in terms of the auto industry. Because basically in the late 1970s, when the post-World War II capitalist boom busted, the capitalist class went on the attack. And in the United States, the UAW was considered the union that set the mark for everybody. Like, what they would get with a contract, other unions would try to emulate. They were, like, considered the top of the line for the labor movement. Starting in the late 70s, that trend played a reactionary role in this sense. The UAW started to take concessions. They started to do givebacks, right? And you had actually a combination of two things. New York City public sector workers, when the city almost went bankrupt in the midst, they started taking big, massive concessions and givebacks. And then the UAW started in the late 70s. And both of those things started a trend where when you went to get a contract, instead of getting more wages, more benefits, better working conditions, it was like you'd give back stuff that you used to have. And they also started these tier systems. So they say, well, we won't hit the workers who are already hired by the company, but anyone new who gets hired, he's not going to make or she's not going to make what these other people used to make.
And that's also another way to divide workers, right? Because now you're pitting like the older workers against the younger workers.
That's right. So you started having that trend. So in that UAW strike that we just saw, on the positive side, there was that, right? And they did get a big raise. And you can see the results of that was that you do have all these non-union auto companies in the United States now, like Toyota and Mercedes and Volkswagen and the Korean car companies and all that. And so a lot of the workers there said, hey, we want what the UAW has got. You know, they saw that not only they were getting a big raise, but when you look at what the top pay rates are for people who've been there for a while at the UAW, you know, if you're in the UAW, if you work for Ford or GM or Stellantis for a while, you look at that compared to people who've worked for that kind of time in Volkswagen or Honda or whatever, they're not making that same kind of money. So you did have that was like served as kind of a magnet and brought a lot of those workers towards the idea of unionizing, of organizing, of becoming part of the UAW. That's the positive side, right? And then the negative side, though, is actually if you look at what Sean Fain was proposing, not what they actually got, but what he was proposing, which was a lot of very good things. For example, pensions, real defined benefit pensions, which were the heart of a lot of the wage and salary agreements and as part of the benefits for the workers in GM and Ford and Stellantis, right? But the people who work there now, the people who've been hired in the recent period, they don't get those defined benefit. They don't get those pensions. They get the 401k, which is basically you got to save for your own retirement. If you don't have enough savings, you work till you die. You know, that's basically what that is. And he wanted to get that expanded to all the workers. That was not achieved in that contract. Also, if you look at the overall wage settlements, when you look at how bad things had got because the UAW had given up the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, for decades, right? And if you look at that and measure it, they didn't really really make any gains. They were just like they were treading water, basically. You know, again, it's relatively good compared to the more recent contracts of the UAW.
I mean, they got what, like 25% wage increase?
Yeah, and I think it was even Fain himself who said something like, if you look at when we gave up the COLA and you look at the cost of living, how it's increased, I think the cost of living increased 40% and the wages, it wasn't exactly equal. We do have the figures in our article, by the way. Maybe you can link that on, but there's actual figures for that. So there's positive and negative. And I think more, the thing is I think more could have been achieved in that strike. The thing is that Sean Fain had this strategy of what he calls a stand-up strike, right? Which was a way of answering the sit-down strike in the 1930s. But the sit-down strike, that idea was you shut down the entire factory, right? They actually shut down and occupied the GM plant at Flint, Michigan, right? And then their main demand was that GM recognized the UAW to negotiate for all of its members, wherever they worked for GM, not just at Flint. That was the kind of all-encompassing campaign.
That's what you call an industrial unionism, right?
Right. They wanted to represent all the workers company-wide, not go plant by plant, you know, like, oh, we'll have a vote at this plant, have a vote. No, they said, wherever you work, if you work for GM, if you're a member of the UAW, you're going to be represented by this union. And that was what they achieved, by the way. That's what the victory of the Flint, Michigan, the sit-down strike in the 1930s. But in this strike, the stand-up strike, what happens is they shut down this factory, they shut down that factory. A lot of the workers were not called out on strike. And it just kind of put a little pressure on the bosses. So the bosses did give more than they've given in, let's say, a couple of decades. But much more could have been achieved. And certainly, according to Sean Fain's own original demands, it was not as much as I think he had called originally for 40% increase plus COLA and all that, you know. And I think he pointed out the fact that the managers had gotten like even more than that, or at least that kind of raise. So that was a weakness. Now, on the Starbucks question, yeah, I mean, here, this is very interesting. Here you have this huge industry or this huge business right around the country, Starbucks. What do they have? 9,000 stores, I think. Is it 9,000 cafes in the United States? I'd have to look it up, but they have quite a bit. I know in New York, sometimes if you stand on an intersection, you could see three of them.
Is it not 17,000?
Oh, 17. They have a lot of stores, right? And they have a lot of employees. And these people are not paid wages that they could make a good living. So here you had a lot of young people who wanted to organize a union. And then to its credit, there was this new union formed, the Starbucks Workers United, which was an attempt to organize that, right? So that was, again, a very exciting thing, very important thing. And they have had some success in this sense that, first of all, when the union campaign started to kick off, Howard Schultz, at that time, who was head of the company, he immediately raised wages and benefits for all the non-union workers, mm-hmm. which was, by the way, illegal even by the capitalist labor laws, even not even talking about from our point of view, but even from the capitalist labor laws, it was illegal because he was discriminating against people who chose to join the union. Mm-hmm. But he immediately raised it. Now, that raise was a byproduct of that union effort. Let's be clear, because he wasn't going to give that raise and, you know, without that. So that was one victory. And then the next victory is that eventually they pressured the company so that now the company basically removed Schultz from being the decision maker, and they put someone else in there, and they've now decided to negotiate with the union to make some sort of a deal.
By the way, one of the reasons why they made this move, right, I think, is because the union released a statement defending Palestine against this genocidal war. And I think basically Starbucks came out against it. Then there was like a big uproar because Starbucks, they pretend like they're this progressive sort of company or whatever. And there was a big, big backlash. So they said, okay, we'll sit down and we'll talk and maybe we'll recognize the 400 or so stores that they have achieved in terms of unionizing, that they're going to sit down at the table, recognize the union and actually start those talks.
Yeah. Also, and when that played out, I think there a lot of their stores, particularly in the Middle East, those tended to be quite empty at a certain point. And so now they're taking a new tact. And they said, okay, we're going to negotiate with the union and we'll try to get a deal for these 400 stores. But it remains to be seen what the deal is. If you expect to get a very high wage and high benefits and good working conditions from Starbucks, you need a lot of leverage. And if you've got, let's say, 400 or 500 stores unionized, but they have, 17,000 stores, you're still just getting just a piece of that, you know? Again, I think the union would be much more successful if they had tried to strategy that the UAW tried in the 1930s, right? And they should say that when we make a deal, this deal is going to apply to anyone who works for Starbucks who's a member of our union, regardless of what store they work in. Once you do that, all of a sudden, if you publicize that and you publicize a series of demands, like, for example, a minimum $30 an hour wage. If they put that out there, what would happen is a whole bunch of Starbucks workers from all over the country would join this union. Now, when they have all these people, then you can organize in those localities. You can have meetings, bring all these people together. Because, you work in a Starbucks, what is it, 30 people, 40 people, maybe even less, right, in a particular store. Those small numbers can make people feel vulnerable. There's nothing like bringing people together. Take, you have 100, Starbucks stores in this area, bring all the union people together, have a big meeting, right? If you can't meet inside, meet outside, meet on the street. Just that feeling of power, just the workers who are in the union, seeing other workers, seeing that kind of large body of workers all organized together to fight for these demands, that would create a tremendous amount of momentum. I guarantee if the union started to do that, these people who are bargaining for Starbucks will want to cut across that. And that means that there would be more pressure on them to give in to at least some of the demands. But if you really want something, you really want some real measurable change, nobody should go into this thinking it's easy. It takes a fight. It takes a struggle, right? The first thing we have to tell workers is tell them the truth. And anybody who's lived in the United States in the last decades, right, who looks at if you tell people it's easy, oh yeah, we're going to unionize, it's easy, we're going to get bigger wages and bigger benefits, it's easy. You're not telling people the truth. So you have to start by telling the people the truth. And then the working class will decide when it's ready to fight. And when it's ready to fight, when it moves, nothing's going to stop it. Nothing can stop the power of the working class.
Now, Tom, some people might say, isn't that illegal, what you just described, to unionize across all of the stores nationwide? Is that allowed?
Well, let's put it this way. If you go by the National Labor Relations Board rules, they say, it must go store by store, location, quote unquote, unless both parties agree to having an industrial thing. So that should be part of the demand, is they should demand that Starbucks say, we're not going to do this store by store. We're doing it nationally. And we want everyone who's a member of our union, wherever they work, is going to be covered by this contract. So that should be part of the demand. That should be part of the mobilization. But when we say things are illegal, again, we can use this to educate the workers as part of the struggle. Why is it illegal? Who made it illegal? Oh, that's the government again. Remember the government that we talked about this before? They keep calling it our government. It's not our government, is it? It's the government of the capitalist class. It's the government of the Democrats and Republicans. By the way, did Joe Biden rescind any of these laws? Did the Democrats, when they controlled Congress, did Obama, when he was president and the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, what did they do to repeal these laws. What did Jimmy Carter do when he had control of the White House and the Congress? You know, these are all Democrats, Bill Clinton, right? These are all past Democratic presidents. They had periods when they had control of the Congress, Democrats in both houses. What did the labor movement get from that, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, what else is illegal? Solidarity strikes are illegal, right?
What you're talking about is a Taft-Hartley law. And the Taft-Hartley law, which was passed in 1947, was part of the Red Scare. And it was a series of attacks against labor to make things illegal. These are things, by the way, they weren't necessarily legal before, but they became illegal, right? They were illegalized by the Democrats and Republicans who ran the government at that time. But the thing is here's my question. When we talk about illegal, it was also illegal for a black person to sit in the front of a bus. So should they have not sat in front of the bus in the South because that was illegal? And it was illegal to have blacks and whites sitting at a particular lunch counter at Woolworth in the South at that time. And was that something that people should have, that a law that we should abide by? You know, there's never been any change in this country that's happened simply just by obeying laws, you know? Whatever there's been big change in this country, usually it involved people in the masses breaking the law, the masses using their power, scaring the ruling class into changing the laws. That's usually what happens. It's not that you wait and you write a letter to your congressman and then they make the law change and then everything, okay, now guys, we can do it.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's often illegal, picket lines that actually work. If you have workers, you have a picket line that prevents scabs from coming in. How do you prevent it? Ultimately, I mean, it's by force, you know? And if you try that, ask the miners, the people in the miner strikes in Alabama, they try to do that and then they get a big fine and they get asked to stop doing it. So then what's the point of a strike? They're actually taking away all the things that can make a strike successful, which is to shut down the workplace and not allow anyone to come in and work as a replacement. We argue that as communists, we need to be active in the struggles that are happening today to unionize and so forth. And we need to do that not just by respecting the rules that the capitalists impose on us, but rather arguing for class struggle methods. And basically, we want to go into every workplace where we have comrades and start building communist cells.
I worked at Trader Joe's for about 7 years, and at the time, you know, we had just come out of the first Bernie Sanders movement. It was very dejecting for me. I was a Bernie bro. I had the sticker on my car for a little too long, too. But anyway, and so I would talk politics at the workplace all the time. And eventually, after I had come to Marxism, I realized that I needed to try to win people over at my workplace to those ideas because I couldn't see another way out of the situation. And for years, a lot of them were like, well, Dave, that sounds all nice in theory, but in practice, I don't think it's going to work. But I kept chucking, and I didn't stop. And at any opportunity, I had to talk about the ideas, particularly when there were issues at work or if somebody saw something in the news they didn't understand. I always put forward, you know, Marxist perspectives, and I gained some political authority amongst my coworkers. Yeah, I was at Trader Joe's in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I was able to recruit three other people. One of them was my manager, who will remain nameless. We had a cell at that workplace. And in 2020, they were calling grocery workers essential workers. And Trader Joe's was making a killing, actually, off of, you know, the pandemic. And there was a Twitter page called the Trader Joe's Union that said that we should get paid hazard pay. And all these people I talked to for years were asking me, Dave, what do you think about the union? And suddenly I became the person to come to. Some people even were like, Dave, can you organize this thing for us? And, you know, throughout that process, I had to really kind of explain, like, well, what is a union? What's the role of a union? Like, what do we need to do beyond unionization, right? And honestly, the work I did was before we had this huge wave of communists across this country. And it was doable then, like you could build a cell. Now, I think if you have like the patience and the right perspectives and you take advantage of opportunities that come before you, I think anybody could build a communist cell in their workplace.
And that experience happened even before the George Floyd movement erupted. And actually, this comrade moved from the Bay Area to Minneapolis that same year. And he transferred to a different Trader Joe's, which was right in the middle of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so in that context, a lot of his coworkers were a lot more open to revolutionary ideas.
Yeah, it was in Minneapolis. I had moved to Minneapolis and I was in a downtown store, which was at the heart of the George Floyd movement. I mean, this store, basically, they had protocols to what to do if there were, you know, protests in the streets. But it was crazy going from my old store to this store. The first person I talked to about politics told me they were a Marxist. And then I found myself talking to every person there, and they all would say they were communists. The most right-wing person I remember at the store said they were a social democrat. I saw this kind of opportunity arise again, and I was able to organize a reading group around the classics and begin to basically build another cell. But later on, that store ended up having a union drive. It was the second Trader Joe's to organize a union in the whole country. And people remembered me from that work then and asked me to MC the rally before the union vote. And, you know, I'm not saying that if you go into your workplace, you should say, "Hey, everybody, I'm a communist." You need to understand the conditions at your workplace. And let me just add to that. You can build anywhere in this country today. It's just you have to know what you're dealing with on the ground. If you have a young workforce and you're asking them about their politics and they tell you you're communist, absolutely, you are a communist too, right? So you just have to figure out how you can like insert yourself into the discussion in these workplaces and do it in a safe way. Like, a good communist doesn't get themselves fired instantaneously. You can build nothing if you no longer work at a workplace, right? A good communist takes the time, is patient, and builds in preparation for events. If we want the labor movement to succeed in the coming period, we need communist cells like the one I tried to build in every workplace, in every community, in every school across the country. But luckily for us, there are literally millions of communists in this country today, and they're looking for a party that can put forward the right political positions and that can build these kinds of things. So it might sound daunting, but it's probably a lot easier than you think.
That's right. Where there's one communist, there will be two and three and four and so on and so forth.
That's also what we do is, let's say there's a strike. Well, we want to all of our comrades should be there supporting that strike. Join the picket lines.
This is Diego from DFW, Texas. And I've been going down to the Molson Coors picket line. You know, the workers organized by Teamsters. I think it's local 997 down in Fort Worth. I've been going down there with several other comrades. It's been 12 weeks now since the start of the strike. We've been there at least, you know, once or twice every week. It's a very important experience. I mean, we're actually connecting with the workers, with the labor movement. This is what we're talking about. Communists being the ones to connect the economic issues with the political issues, right? I've talked to several workers. One of the workers actually goes up to me and Nathan, and he has, you know, a veteran hat. He has a veteran shirt, and he asks, like, you know, where we're coming from and all that. He sees my paper because I'm holding the communist, issue number one. And he talks about, well, you know, you should really educate yourself on these things before you go on, like, pushing it or, like, advertising it. And in general, he had a lot of misconceptions about communism. He definitely also believed in some of, like, the conspiracies that are pushed by Fox News. He thought that the Democrats were communists. But, you know, me and Nathan, we make that clear distinction that, like, you know, China is not communist, Russia is not communist. They're actually just as capitalist as the United States. And that we're not Democrats or Republicans. We don't align with those two. We only align with the workers. We're class independent. And then after that, he really liked us a lot more. So that's the thing. Like, when you show them, like, you know, communism is y'all. Like, communism is the workers. That's what we're trying to fight for. Then a lot of workers will actually listen to you. And this is in Fort Worth, where it's a lot of rural workers, you know, kind of coming from the countryside or just small towns, but they're still open. A lot of them are sympathetic. This other worker that I was talking to yesterday, how You know, it's the workers that do everything. They're the ones that create everything for the companies. And if there's any job that needs to be AI, you know, automated, it's the CEO's job. And that, you know, in fact, if workers had their hands in this technology that's been created, it could be used so much more efficiently, so much for so much more productivity. I mean, this worker, he definitely knows a lot more about, you know, productivity and in the industry than any CEO or any, you know, stockholder. He also was talking about how the conflict in Palestine doesn't benefit him. It's not in his interest at all. And that all that money that's being sent to Israel instead should be used here first before it goes outside of the country. So there's definitely a lot of radicalization for these workers. And we really just need to connect, you know, this economic issue that they're fighting for needs to be connected to politics. That in order to really make sure that these demands are kept, we need a political party that's able to connect all these different issues. That's able to, for example, connect this issue of workers demanding for better wages and conditions, connected to the Palestinian movement, and tell them, you know, these same bosses that are, you know, driving down your wages and are you know, attacking your working conditions, they're the same ones that benefit off the genocide in Palestine, right, in Gaza. And the only way to fundamentally end this, the only way to fundamentally, you know, make your lives better under is not, you know, just limiting yourself under the system. It's making the whole system go. Very invaluable experience that I think our comrades should, you know, if you have someone around you that's striking, that, then, you know, that's holding a picket on, definitely go down there, because that's very needed.
All of these things, I think, are going to help to increase the influence of communism generally among the workforce, and also the influence to put forward class struggle methods within the union movement, which is absolutely what is needed.
And we will fight inside the labor movement. And we, to the extent that we are not in the leadership of the unions, we have to hold the feet of the labor leaders, you know, to the fire, so to speak. We have to push demands on them. We should explain, why are you not organizing the full force of this union to fight, to win these demands? This is where the money should come from. This is how we can get it. Yes, we have to break those laws. We have to break the boss's laws made by the people who you tell us to vote for in November, right? We have to expose all of those things. By doing that, I actually believe a very small group of communists who do it consistently could gradually win over the sympathy of a large amount of workers, because I think if there's one thing people know is that there's a lot of anger and dissatisfaction at the workplace. Anyone who's listening to this, I bet, ask yourself, go around the work. Do you see a bunch of happy people there? Is everybody thrilled about the conditions? No. In fact, you see the opposite. There's a lot of potential here, but we just have to give it a direction. And once we start having some victories, even small victories, those will mushroom. Just like I was saying in 1934, a few victories in this country, and it started a whole wildfire.
Tune in next week for part two of this episode, where Tom will explain how the communists built the unions in the U.S. and how we can reclaim the class war and revolutionary traditions of the American working class.